This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Fire up the DeLorean. We're going back in time. The History of WWE.com proudly presents the History of Wrestling Podcast right here on Place to Be Nation.
Dan, talk to me more about these underground levels on Mario.
You really want to hear about the underground levels in Mario?
I want to hear about the underground levels in Mario.
You got blue bricks, a black background, you got that really dark, sinister do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do music. Those levels are actually some of my favorites, actually.
I hated those levels because you're underground, so you're like buried, and they've got the do-do-do-do-do-do, which made me nervous as a 7-year-old.
I was a very nervous jumper. It's going to sound like a personal problem, but I was a very nervous jumper in all those games, so I always thought I was overshooting the mark when it came to those. But the worst...
Well, welcome back to This Week in Super Mario History. This is Graham... No, this is not that show. That show should not exist. That show is way too niche of a fan base.
Everybody loves Mario.
No, but this week in Mario history cannot be a thing.
I think it's a thing. I think you just made it a thing.
Okay. It's a thing. If it's on Twitter tomorrow, we know we've got some sway.
You know, Place
this
to Be,
is.
Graham, hold on. Place to Be basically adds a new podcast like every 45
that's
minutes.
True.
So we might have be onto something here talking Mario for the next 90 minutes.
Do we have to host it?
We could. It's our idea.
I could not host that show. Anyway, this is the History of Wrestling Podcast here on the Place to Be Nation. I'm Graham Cawthon along with Brad Studs, Dan McGinn. It's been a while, guys. How are you?
It's been a while, but I can still. Anybody remembers that one? I remember that one. I'm well. Things are good in the Carolinas. No complaints. It's starting to get fucking hot as shit here. Dan, how is it up in the New England area?
It went from freezing cold to extraordinarily hot and humid in like a matter of a couple days. Two days ago, there was talk of people still putting their heat on because it was getting cold again and rainy, but now it's actually quite nice and sunny.
Good. I'm glad it's not just me.
Well, today it's a little, and I know, Brad, we're not in the same room in the Carolinas, but it's a little cold today. It's like in the 60s.
We should be in the same room always, buddy.
You think so?
I miss your scent. Your musk.
You would never be cold.
Well, I would come hang out soon, but I'm hanging out with Muda.
No, you're not, because that show's not going to happen.
Yes, it is, because I already got tickets.
That does not mean it's going to happen.
I mean, we're gonna blow red mist in each other's face.
And if I egregiously slander someone here, my apologies. But yeah, there's some wacky tour that supposedly is gonna have the great Muta appearing in Graham's hometown of Shelby. I don't know anything about the people that are putting the shows together, but I am skeptical to say the least. Only because of so many people that start running shows with big aspirations and things just don't pan out. Sometimes very legitimately, you know, they lose funding or this or that or whatever. So I am skeptical that this thing will take off. Again, apologies if I am egregiously slandering anyone. And it may happen and it may be cool, but I've heard and seen a lot of big shows advertised that never come to fruition for one way or another.
You're completely right. It's a limited tour. They've got some names like Kevin Sullivan and I think Funaki is on there and the Powers of Pain, I think. But I think primarily it's a Japanese promoted. So there's a lot of names from Japan on there that you might not otherwise know or the average fan. But the main draw is Muta to get people in the door. I think there's a show in Atlanta. I think Shelby is the default Charlotte stop, which is a little interesting because Shelby really hasn't drawn since the Rock and Roll Express won the tag team titles in 1985. So
is
it's
it in
an
that
interesting...
venue? Is it in yeah, the old 80s venue?
Yeah, it's the City Park Gym.
Nice.
Yeah. Which we've had a few shows here over the past 6 or 7 years, but we even had one of those Flair shows with Reed and David, and David lives in Shelby, and it did not even sell out with Ric Flair.
Is that where they wrestled the Nasty Boys?
No, that was Charlotte. That was the Hogan show. I was at that show. That was a pretty cool show. Yeah. No, this was a Ricky Nelson show. Remember Ricky Nelson from Crockett?
Job guy? I remember Ricky Nelson very well. Ricky Nelson was the headliner on some of the first indie shows I ever went to. Back in the early 90s, if you went to an independent show in like the Carolinas or Georgia or even Virginia, a lot of times the headline guys would be enhancement guys from Crockett because they had some – they could all work. They were used as enhancement guys, but they had some name value. People knew who Ricky Nelson and Colt Steele and George South and David Isley and Chuck Coates. People knew who those guys were. So a lot of times they would be put in positions on independent cards in the Carolinas where you could really see what they could do, and all those guys could work, and all those guys did good, or did well, I guess I should say. But yeah, so I've known Ricky for a long time.
Yeah, that was a Ricky Nelson show, and I think the main event was David and Reed against Ricky Nelson and Buff Bagwell.
Bagwell is pretty much always in the upper echelon of the Ricky Nelson circuit.
But I want to share this visual with you guys. Okay, imagine Bagwell with the goofy ass top hat. Okay, remember the top hat?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Charging like $10 or $15 per Polaroid photo.
Can I give away one of the secrets of the business?
Sure.
Is that allowed? Will I be lambasted by my peers if I give away the secrets of the business?
Probably.
My wife, on more than one occasion, was called because we did a lot of shows with Buff back in like 2004, 2005, 2006. My wife, on more than one occasion, was asked by Buff to be the stand-in, the first person to jump in line.
No way.
To make the announcement, because then that breaks the ice, and anyone who might feel skittish or whatever about jumping into line, well, there's already one or two people up there, blah blah blah. So my wife was the icebreaker for Bagwell's Polaroid line on more than one occasion back in like 2005 and 2006.
That's pretty smart. I've yeah. used that similar setup for very different situations, but I've done that myself many times. So that's actually pretty smart.
Yeah, it's I'm always impressed by people like that. I can't remember if I've told the story on here or not before, but Brooke Tessmacher got over with me so big at the Los Angeles Wrestle Reunion because I'm friends with the High Spots crew, and I'm really tight with the guy who gives the assignments, or the guy who was in charge of the assignments on that particular day. So I was tearing the tickets for the Brooke Adams poolside bikini photo op. Real difficult day in my life. I don't mind
that. That's awful.
No, it was horrible. It was Brooke and Shelly at different points. Shelly Martinez. It was Brooke and Shelly at different points. But Brooke got over with me that day because, you know, she did, you know, she's in a bikini and she looks amazing and she's taking pictures and stuff and such. And about halfway through the line, she's like, you know, hold up 1 second, comes over to me, takes the torn tickets out of my hand and counts the ticket stubs. She wanted to make sure she knew what her cut should be. And I was like, you know what? I've never had anybody do that in all these conventions, but you just got so fucking over with me because a lot of people don't. Like I said, I've never had anybody else that like at least not in front of me, that wanted a count of the torn ticket stubs so they knew whatever deal she had negotiated, she wanted to know what her cut should be. And that really got over with me. I thought that was really sharp. And what she did it, I couldn't believe more people hadn't done it. Because, like, I had worked tables for, like, Afa and Sika and Bruno. And I've been at the table for a lot of big-name people, and I was really surprised that of all the people in the business, Brooke Adams was the first person that I ever saw do that. They might have done it, you know, behind closed doors when it got to be just them and the boss, but she wanted to make sure she knew the count in her head. And I thought that was really impressive. It was a smart girl, very charming girl.
This is a different topic, but you had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to do something that not a whole lot of people have been able to do yet, myself included, because I haven't been over there, but to check out the new Andre the Giant Museum in North Carolina.
Yeah, very cool.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was just kind of a fluke thing. I had seen there's a dude who had put up a couple of articles, and people kind of in the North Carolina community had, or North Carolina wrestling community, I should say, had been sharing this guy's articles. And you know, he really did a great service to the opening and everything, because he was kind of the one covering it. And I had seen one that was like, you know, today is going to be opening day. There's going to be a deal, like almost like a little ribbon cutting at.
Well, not to interrupt, but they opened smartly on his birthday, which is also my wife's birthday.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I mean, I realized it's his birthday.
Yeah, May 19th.
But yeah, it was a really cool deal, and so I happened to see the article once again that was like, you know, where they're opening, they're doing like the ribbon cutting and everything at 7 o'clock, and it's in a little town called Ellerby, which not a ton of people even in the Carolinas would know about, just a small community, but nevertheless, I had seen the article that said, you know, ribbon cutting and that kind of thing at 7 p.m. and it just so happens that Ellerby is only about an hour, less than an hour, away from where my mother stays. I had visited my mother, and we were grabbing a bite to eat, me and my wife, and I realized that it was like 5:45 p.m., and I was like, you know, we could make Ellerby by 7. And so very impulsively, we just went. It's a little town in the country. It's a little north of Rockingham, for anyone geographically that might know a little bit about the Carolinas. And it was really cool. Like, it was just a little impulsive thing that we did. And we got to be there for the ribbon cutting, and got to talk to Jackie Frenchie Bernard's widow. Who, for anyone that doesn't know, Frenchie Bernard was a referee and a manager in a lot of southern territories in the 70s, and ended up being kind of Andre's caretaker of his land during the last, you know, years of his life, and also after he died. And it was very, very cool. They have a life-sized fat head of Andre on the wall, so you can kind of stand next to it for a photo op. Tons of cool stuff, like a drawing from Rock and Wrestling, from the people that did Rock and Wrestling, like a little character sketch of Andre that they had sent him. Boots, his All Japan jacket from one tour, his All Japan Pro Wrestling jacket, which is massive, of course. And the coolest thing for me, and like legitimately one of the coolest things I've ever seen, is Andre had broken his leg or done something to his leg. It's not the Killer Khan instance. This is when he's on the two walking canes, like when he manages the Bushwhackers at like 90, 91. And whatever had happened to him, Brett did a drawing of the whole roster, a cartoon, and gave it to him as a get well gift. And I was like, and it's in like a glass case and everything. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. And you walk around it, and the back of it is signed by everybody.
Oh, wow.
Hogan,
nice.
Warrior, Brett, Shawn, Demolition, Boss Man, Akeem, Duggan, Rude, everybody that was in the Fed in end of 90, beginning of 91, whenever this was, Paul Roma, Brooklyn Brawler, it's signed by everybody. You know, get well, boss. Love you, boss. Love you, Andre, whatever. And it's legit one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And I'm just like, you know, I hope I'm very, very glad that it's preserved. And if it's me, if I'm doing the marketing, I do reproductions of that and I sell them in the gift shop. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's seriously one of the coolest things.
Correct me.
Speaking of which, is there a gift shop?
There's a gift shop for the museum itself. On the grand opening, all they had was the book that I think maybe Keith Elliott Greenberg co-wrote.
Oh, the WWE book?
Yeah.
I'm in that.
Oh, you're in that? They had it.
Not to put myself over, but the one that came out like 10 years ago?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That is so cool. Okay.
Yeah. But another cool thing was Jackie... Frenchie Bernard's widow had a stack of Andre's last promo pictures that he did with New York. And they were kind of giving them away to people that came. It was just a small stack, but they were giving them away to people that came to the grand opening. And I thought that was really cool because it wasn't like – reproductions or anything. Like Andre probably touched these, you know, so I thought that was kind of neat. Shout out to William Toler, who I met that day. That's the guy that was writing all the pieces promoting the opening, and it's really cool. If anyone is ever in that part of the Carolinas, I definitely recommend checking it out. It's maybe an hour or so from Greensboro. Not quite sure where it would be from, like Charlotte or from Graham's area, but it's worth checking out. And I will say it looks like a small space, but they really maximize the space. Like there's a ton of stuff in the exhibit cases. There's a ton of stuff on the walls. His collection of all his WrestleMania caps, like baseball caps of like 1 through 7, and then like a Saturday Night's Main Event cap, which I tried to get under my jacket and I couldn't get out of the place with it. And a lot of really cool stuff. It was very neat. It was a lot of work and care and time was put into cultivating it. It was very cool.
Well, hopefully I can get over there. I'd love to do a road trip by the end of the month to check it out. Mm-hmm. But the two things that I want to talk about today, one of them we'll get to immediately, is Elimination Chamber. That's the most recent pay-per-view. But more importantly than that, it was a show that seemed to really get some good finishes in there. And finishes, just as a general topic, I don't know if it's talked about too much. We like to talk about, you know, whoever won, but not necessarily how they won. And so we're going to talk about Elimination Chamber. I'd love to get you guys' thoughts on that. And then after the break, when we come back, I want to talk about finishes. And specifically what brought that up would have been the Dean Ambrose-Seth Rollins match and that conclusion, which most of us refer to as a dusty finish. Is a dusty finish good? Is a dusty finish bad? You know, obviously about 10 or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, we were seeing a lot more of them than we are now. So what'd you guys think about the last pay-per-view?
My biggest thing is I was talking to a friend of mine about this. It's like you had your Extreme Rules and you had Payback and now you have Elimination Chamber and shortly after that, we're going to have Money in the Bank. I almost feel like instead of four cards, they should have just made two really good cards instead of just four, you know, kind of middle of the road cards, but we'll see what happens with Money in the Bank. It usually over delivers. This was exactly what the what the network should be, is here's your award, you have the network, we're going to throw this special bonus show at you, and you can fill a Sunday night. And that's what exactly what I got out of this, is I was thoroughly entertained for most of this. You could argue that it was basically a one-match show, maybe two-match show, I would say. And that didn't even include the Elimination Chamber matches themselves, which usually those are the two, those are the bouts that carry an Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. And they didn't necessarily need to because of the main event and, of course, the Kevin Owens-John Cena match, I'm sure we'll talk about a lot, really was a terrific performance by both individuals. And it's weird because the low points were actually the big Elimination Chamber matches. If you, particularly in that Intercontinental title, it seemed like it was kind of a cluster with all kinds of just bad improv-ing and maybe some questionable eliminations in certain order. And same could be said about the tag team one. But you certainly got the bang for your buck, and particularly for those that had this month for free, being able to get a Payback pay-per-view and then this pay-per-view, this special event on top of it, not a bad deal, even if you're only paying that $10 a month. But, yeah, I can't really say enough about the Owens-Cena match. I mean, it was one of those things where sometimes you watch some of these shows and you think, well, I could do other things too while I'm doing this. I could look at my phone, I can check Twitter, I can do all kinds of other things. That was a match that you know, you were doing yourself a disservice if you were trying to multitask, because it was just an entertaining match from bell to bell.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I thought it was a fine show. My constant gripe, so to speak, my constant complaint, whatever you want to say, has been for some time now that not enough big, important stuff happens on pay-per-views. And that it needs to, you need to cater to the television, should cater to the big events, not the other way around. With the advent of the network, perhaps we are in the early stages of a very official shift in that, because we are in an age where the television is seen by so many more people than the pay-per-views, live events, whatever you want to call them. And so it kind of, you know, I can buy the argument for putting the best stuff on television or whatever. Having said that, I kind of go, I kind of take the contrary opinion to Dan. I think I like the four shows. I think when we look back on the Elimination Chamber historically and put it into a historical context, I think it's going to be the first of many live network specials, because I think that creates a whole other scenario wherein tons of people can get opportunities that they might not have gotten in traditional pay-per-views, and even concepts. You know, we could see a Halloween Havoc, we could see a Starrcade, we could see all kinds of stuff, as just like the Elimination Chamber was. Take a scheduled Sunday house show and upgrade it to a live network special. And that can change the game. I think if this continues to prove to be a winning formula, I think we're probably less than 2 years away from 26 major, quote-unquote, events a year, as opposed to 12 pay-per-views a year, in my opinion.
And in your opinion, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, it all depends on the landscape at the time. Right now, in 2015, I'm going to say that's a good thing. And here's why. The television, and Dave Meltzer has wrote about this, if you read the Wrestling Observer, and a couple other people have wrote about this, the television feels much more focused with 2 weeks in between major events rather than four or five, where they have to stretch angles out for longer. Now, you know, there's lots of ways of fixing that, up to and including, you know, beefing up creative with people who are a little more prolific or whatever. But in the current landscape, I think it's a good thing for that very reason. I think if the people whose job it is to write the show and produce the segments find it easier with a major event every 2 weeks instead of every 4 or 5, and the network reaps benefit from doing it that way, then I'm going to say that's the best way of doing it with the current lay of the land. Mm-hmm. Could that change in a couple of years? Would that have been true 5 years ago? No. Could that change 5 years from now? Absolutely. Or even 1 year from now. But I don't know. Feel free to chime in. But it seems to me like the television does feel more focused with only 2 weeks in between the shows.
Yeah, I think a lot of things maybe over the past month or so have seemed a little bit more focused. I don't know if that's the emergence of acts like the New Day or what it is, but it seems like they're kind of building some momentum and creating some new stars that can do some new things. I thought that that Raw in particular, where they had New Day go over, I think it was Reigns and Orton to open the show, was very much something that you would have seen back in like 2000 with Edge and Christian beating two main event guys.
Yeah, I agree.
That kind of gave me some optimism there, not to mention a different show that we're doing right now. I really enjoyed Elimination Chamber, and I don't know if that's because going in the bar was not set, you know, too far out of reach or what it was, but the fact that they took what has historically always been a main event world title stipulation match and gave it to the tag team titles, gave it to the IC title, could only elevate those titles. And we got I think it was close to a 25-minute tag team title match. Yeah, it had six teams in it, but when was the last time we had a 25-minute tag team title match? The IC title Elimination Chamber gave credibility to Ryback as the guy holding that title. The tag team Elimination Chamber gave credibility to the New Day as a tag team that will cheat if they can, and they found a way to cheat and hold on to the titles, but still, they survived. Ryback survived. And then you get Owens and Cena, and then you get Ambrose and Rollins. So I thought it was maybe not a blow it out of the water pay-per-view, mm-hmm. but in terms of a WWE Network exclusive, I thought it was fun. I thought it was fantastic. I thought they did a great job in building new players, but then also giving us a huge discussion point coming out of it that leads directly into Money in the Bank.
Well, the thing is you will not hear me argue against New Day being propped up and showcased on a special event. I mean, again, I'm still pumping my chest and writing about how great they are. There's a term up here in New England, if you're kind of like in the bag for a particular team, you're basically so much of a fan that you'd be wearing their footy pajamas. I am wearing New Day footy pajamas, as it were, when it comes to them, and I think that was a great decision for them to win. And you know, you have a lot of hungry challengers on the horizon for them. I will say this, I mean, would this special event even have happened had it not been for Daniel Bryan having to give up the Intercontinental title? Would they have even had this event, or would Daniel Bryan have performed in an Elimination Chamber match defending the Intercontinental title had that not happened?
I'm guessing that would have been the plan.
Yeah, you know, so I like that idea, particularly now that you have just the one major world title. Some of these belts kind of need that propping up. And we saw this after WrestleMania. You know, John Cena wins the U.S. title. He does the U.S. Open Challenge. Now, all of a sudden, you want to see the U.S. title match on Raw, SmackDown, the special event, because you never know what's going to happen. People really want to see the result of that. And now the same can be said about this particular instance with the Intercontinental title. You've basically had, you know, spin the wheel, and where it lands, that's who's going to be your Intercontinental champion. Now it's Ryback, the new face, new big guy defending. And for, again, 20 minutes or so in this show, the Intercontinental title meant something. So in that regard, I do agree. These special events are a good thing. My thing is you guys might have a little bit more faith in the product and creative than I do, because I found it hard for them to stay focused for 12 big shows a year. And if we're talking the possibility of doubling that in the new year because after the success of Elimination Chamber, you know, I mean, there's only so much they could do to have interest. And again, we'll see what will happen from here. But I love the idea of if they brought back like an old WCW NWA concept, maybe not the scaffold match, but you know what I'm saying? It would be kind of neat if this idea is successful.
Yeah. And one thing just to piggyback off that is we're, like I said earlier, we're applying a world title main event stipulation to these titles that for so long people have said, oh, WWF doesn't care about them. You know, they don't mean anything anymore. It's not like the 80s. Well, you know, how do we make you care more? Well, we're going to put more emphasis on them. We're going to, you know, put these historically main event stipulations on them. And so when the guy wins the title, like Ryback, you go, well, I mean, you can't really argue that because look what he did. And speaking of Ryback, you know, he's a guy that maybe traditionally does not fit in with the IWC or, you know, the more critical fans. To his credit, when Ziggler was eliminated, yes, a lot of people turned and a lot of people booed. But within 30 seconds, what were they doing? That whole crowd was chanting Ryback. It wasn't that they were crapping out on the show. It wasn't that they were crapping out on, you know, the rest of the match. They got right back in the match. And that really speaks to him because he's kind of run the gamut in terms of big baby face, big heel, Curtis Axel tag team partner. And now he's kind of back on that big baby face run and the crowd's with him.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think he was a good choice. You know, I felt similarly when Sandow won the Money in the Bank. It was like, you know, good for him, because this is a guy that has paid dues and it's good to see those people get an opportunity. Ryback is far from being the only person that fits that description. There's dozens of people in WWE that fit that description. But for anyone like, you know, him or Axel or Heath Slater or, you know, any of those type of guys, even Dolph, it's always good to see guys get opportunities that you think, you know, wow, this guy has taken his lumps every week and now he's really getting an opportunity, hopefully, to do something. And hopefully he will, and not be, you know, one of those situations like when Barrett or somebody like that had the Intercontinental title and he was getting beat every week in non-title matches. I don't see that as Ryback's fate, but hopefully it won't be. I'm a big believer in protecting the champions on television, and I absolutely loved when New Day beat Randy and Roman for that exact reason. And it does seem like a lot of things that some people have been complaining about for years are being implemented
it seems that there's a gradual shift, because aside from maybe the Rumble, which got a lot of backlash and a lot of people were upset about that, a lot of the subtleties I've really enjoyed with the booking, and that runs, that's from what they've done with Roman since the Rumble. You know, even his involvement at Elimination Chamber, it was kind of minimal, but it was important. He wasn't the focal point, but he will be. You know, even on Raw, when they put him in that what was essentially a gauntlet match, which is something that they were doing with Daniel Bryan 2 years ago, they are building that sympathy. So there's that. There's New Day. There seems to be a lot more care put toward what are we going to do with so-and-so. And yeah, even with guys like Axel and Sandow, which a lot of people, and I do not necessarily disagree, but a lot of people can point and say, well, that's just silly and they don't mean anything. Well, with the Hogan Savage bit, it gives them something to do, even if it's a comedy spot, even if it's a, you know, losing to the Ascension or whatever it is. It, in the short term, it works. And I was tweeting on Raw that SummerSlam just won't feel complete if Axel and Sandow can't get some chick to take off her skirt in front of Big Show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That would be very tremendous.
And that would be crap.
That would be fantastic. It gives them some room to do some new stuff. And is it going to put them in a main event spot? Probably not. But you'll remember what they're doing.
I don't know who said it. It was probably on this airwaves. Maybe it was on Twitter. And someone can always correct me if they follow me on Twitter. But DMAC P2B, by the way. But anyway, someone said it would be a cool idea if they come out as the Genius and Mr. Perfect. And then, of course, Axel would be his father. And then it might have actually been on one of our reaction shows. And, of course, you know, Sandow coming out as the Genius. I think that would be kind of a cool throwback as well. But, yeah, it is entertaining. It is another part of the show, certainly. One thing that I also got from this pay-per-view when I was – or special event when I was watching Twitter and listening to the reaction shows is how many guys from NXT – are kind of making an impact or being important, playing important roles on this particular card. You had the Lucha Dragons, you had the Ascension, had a couple eliminations out there. Of course, Neville and Bo Dallas had a match. Kevin Owens is the champion fighting, the NXT champion fighting on a Big Show, you know, special event. Of course, you know, the whole the entire Shield basically were involved. There was just so many instances like that, you know, that kind of gave a glimpse as to what the future would look like. But as Triple H will now always say, the future is now. Well, you're starting to see that a little bit creeping in there in some of these shows. And maybe because you have more of these big events to look forward to, you might start to see a lot more of that influence when guys start to heal up and then get called up.
Yeah, it really seems that maybe since Mania or before Mania, there's a shift, and that shift is continuing. And honestly, I have not kept up with the backstage stuff in many months because honestly, it makes me not as what's the word? You know, I don't love this business because of who's in control backstage or all that kind of stuff. I love this business because it's just fun. And so I think if you kind of unplug from the dirt sheets and everything, you tend to enjoy what's going on more than if you know what's going to happen next. So I haven't been paying attention. I don't know if Triple H is getting more influence over Vince or whatever the deal is. But I'm enjoying it, and I hope it continues.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think that's something a lot of people have gotten away from in the past, it's been almost 20 years now, is, you know, what's the Jeff Goldblum line from Jurassic Park? We were so interested to see if we could.
Must go faster.
No. We were so interested to see if we could. We never stopped to ask if we should. I think that covers a lot of ground in wrestling in, you know, like the mid or so 90s when it came to a lot of people, you know, who were just starting to get on the internet or just starting to read the dirt sheets or just starting to do whatever to make themselves, quote unquote, smarter to the business. I think a lot of people were so excited that they could do these things. They didn't really stop to say if they should and would it ultimately ruin their enjoyment of this thing. And I think we kind of have a generation of people now, by and large, to different degrees, who have kind of had their enjoyment ruined to varying degrees, because it's weird. It's like a whole new fan now. But I guess that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, I don't – I'm kind of done with being told who to like and who not to like.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are, honestly. You know, I'm really enjoying this just kind of free-flowing, free-form discussion. The one topic we did kind of toss around is finishes, good finishes, bad finishes. Did you boys like the finish to the main event on the Elimination Chamber or not?
I loved it. I popped for it as it was happening. As soon as Rollins pulls the referee in the way, I go, holy crap, are they doing a Dusty finish?
I like that it's been a long enough time that people are happy about that now.
Not me. No, not me. I think I had the loudest F-bomb in this apartment's history, to be honest with you. I've never, and we'll talk about this after the break, but I have never been a fan of this. It is such a tease. It was not that it ruined. I'm not going to, like, you know, kick Basil afterwards, or I'm not going to be like one of these people that say, oh, I'm going to cancel the network because I didn't like who won. But I was just so I always fall for it. I am like the worst fan when it comes to the quote.
No, you're the best.
Yeah, for Dusty finishes, because I get so riled up afterwards, like, oh, they got me again, those bastards. Like, that is exactly how I felt. And when you said that this is what we're gonna talk about today, I was like, you know, I might not have the historical references. I can just tell you that when this happens and I happen to not know anything about it, I get really upset about it. And the same could be said from this past Sunday.
All right, so let's go to break real quick. When we come back, we're going to talk about the good, the bad, the dusty.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Chad, do you want your wrestling podcast to be informed by historical and analytical insight and by obsessive watching of footage from any era and any promotion and for them all to be available on one feed?
Sure do, Parv.
Chad, are you ready to shill?
I am, because I know you're talking about the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network.
Let's go through that again. PWOPTBN podcast network.
Got it. That's where you can listen to all sorts of different shows covering the history of pro wrestling in detail.
Shows like Titans of Wrestling with my boys Pete, the man of 10,000 discs, and Kelly, the jobber lover.
I'm a jobber lover.
Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham.
Join me, Stephen Graham.
The smash hit wrestling game show Brainbuster with
Johnny Sorrow.
We have a host of top contributors like wrestling historian Chris Zellner.
Hello, everyone. This is Chris Zellner here, starting a new podcast venture.
And the Pro Wrestling Only admins, the man who knows more about 90s wrestling than maybe anybody on earth, Charles, and good old Will from Texas.
This is Will, and I'm joined today by my good buddy Charles.
Whether it's the territories, WWF, NWA, Mid-South, Texas, Portland, tag team wrestling, Japanese wrestling, lucha, old school, new school, we got it.
And of course, the feed still has the mothership itself,
where the big boys play,
on which we continue our endless journey through WCW supercards.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. It's pro wrestling only.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, guys, welcome back. It is the History of Wrestling, Episode 8. We are talking finishes, the good and the bad and the dusty, as it was eloquently put by my colleague Graham a moment ago. And we are talking about that in this time. But now this is the time that we usually get into. We usually start off hot and go right back into the discussion. But we're going to try to mellow it down a little bit, kind of smooth things, give you our plugs and all that good stuff. And then we're going to get right back into that hard-hitting action with Graham Brad and yours truly, Dan McGinn, with you. And I was talking about earlier podcasts, placetobenation.com, of course. We joke about it earlier that it seems like a new podcast pops up every 5 minutes or so, and that is certainly true. But one of the tried and true podcasts, one of the franchises, if you will, is the Kevin Kelly Show. We just dropped episode 36, incidentally, and some guy that I used to do a show with, I don't know, I kind of carried him for most of it, but his name is Steve Carino. He returned. He made his second appearance on the Kevin Kelly Show. That's number 36. And Graham, we talked a little bit about this during the break, about where you could find this show and others, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But there actually is, for those that don't know, there are actually two feeds that you can get the full gambit of Place to Be Nation content. There's, of course, the Place to Be podcast feed, which includes this show, the Kevin Kelly Show, certainly, you're Wrestling with Optimism, you have, like, now you have a couple different other podcasts that may not necessarily be wrestling related, all of our sports content, whether it's the Extra Point or the Sports Lounge, the Kings of Sport. But that can all be found, of course, on the traditional Place to Be podcast feed. But the other guy in the equation is the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. And that includes a number of shows, including the very popular now Exile on Bad Street, the Pro Wrestling Super Show, the game show that is really popular with Johnny Sorrow called Brain Buster, Goodwill Wrestling. So there's all kinds of different shows from Pro Wrestling Only's affiliation with Place to Be Nation, and that's on its own separate dedicated feed on iTunes. So if you download both of those, you will get just about everything you could ever want from the Place to Be Nation.
That was smooth, Dan.
Yeah.
That was like Rick Rude coming out to Smooth Operator Smooth.
Maybe that should be playing underneath that entire bit there. We'll have to talk about that in editing. I don't know.
You and your ideas, sir.
I need to reconnect with those PW only guys. I used to know, I used to talk to all those guys a lot. I need to reconnect with some of those guys and give those shows a listen, because it's people that I would love to have on one of our shows, and we could have a nice little brand synergy there at some point in the future.
Yeah, a couple other shows to pimp while I'm on here is for the PWO side of things. Those guys do a lot of our reaction shows right immediately after pay-per-views. These guys get together, they go and talk things over, give like a complete reaction, like spot, almost on the spot, and then it gets sent out. And by the next morning, sometimes you'll get that reaction show sent to one of those feeds. There's a new show called the Dangerous Alliance Podcast that's featuring Will from Goodwill Wrestling, I mentioned before, and Justin Rosero, who goes by JT in that show. They do kind of like a various different games and challenges and great wrestling discussion. I play the timekeeper and the annoying guy who tells them how much time they have left on that one. And yeah, it's great stuff, and it's just easy, free downloads for both of those feeds, and get a lot of great wrestling content.
Well, speaking of brand synergy, I do want to let everyone know about the history of WWE.com. Obviously, well, not obviously, maybe you know about it. Maybe you just stumbled across this show while you're looking for like a cooking podcast or something and just found this one instead. By the way, we're big eaters, all of us. Brother. So the history of WWE.com has been around since 2002, and it's far more than just the name. It's Crockett, WCW, ECW, TNA, Ring of Honor. It's a little bit of everything in there, but basically, my goal is to provide the most detailed historic ring results for every show those promotions have ever held. And the most recent book, this would be book number 6, is about to come out, and it's Battleground Baltimore, and it focuses on every pro wrestling event that has ever been held at the Baltimore Arena, now the Royal Farms Arena. Every promotion, whether it be WWE, Crockett, AWA, Pro Wrestling USA, Georgia. So it's been very fortunate and had a blast talking with dozens of fans and wrestlers and backstage crew about their experiences. So putting the final touches on that, I actually did a podcast earlier today with a Baltimore podcast and doing some more Baltimore media here soon. But that is available for pre-order at thehistoryofwwe.com. And all of the other five books are available for only $20 plus shipping for all the U.S. residents. And that is not trying to be pro-U.S. Necessarily. It's just all you other people are so expensive to ship to. And these are heavy books. So just be patient. They'll be on Amazon and Barnes & Noble soon. While you're on thehistoryofwwe.com and you're checking out these old ring results and reviews and everything else, check out our link to Pro Wrestling Tees, ProWrestlingTees.com store. Three different designs on there, and give it a shot.
And while we're all doing plugs, let me very quickly plug CWF Worldwide, which is the new internet show from CWF Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, the group I'm affiliated with here in the Carolinas. Graham has come to a bunch of events. It is traditional pro wrestling presented in the style of Memphis, Continental, Crockett, Smoky Mountain, but with 21st century action and excitement. Trevor Lee, Andrew Everett, Cedric Alexander, Adam Page, and so many more guys from the Carolinas have become some of the hottest properties in wrestling. And that's our goal with CWF Worldwide, to show the whole world the amazing professional wrestling that's happening in the Carolinas right now. New episodes drop every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern time, immediately following NXT and now the Ring of Honor show on Destination America. But if you can't make it to watch live, every single week, the episode is archived and available for viewing 24/7 at your leisure at youtube.com/CWF Mid-Atlantic. And hopefully, if you join us on CWF Worldwide, you will see some finishes that you love and not finishes that you hate, which brings us to our topic of the week, gentlemen.
Well, and I wanted to talk to you about this because, and you don't talk about it much, but you are the booker finish guy at CWF and have done that for many years.
Yeah, was always pitching my ideas for my guys when I was talent. And then August 2010, I officially kind of was handed the reins full time. So it's been about 5 years now of me putting together between 24 and 36 shows a year. And that's not to say I don't have help from people. I don't have ideas pitched, but, you know, the discussion has to stop at some point, and that point is me. And it's very interesting. It has so many moving parts. One of my favorite quotes, Al Snow said, I think it was Al Snow, I'm going to attribute it to him, is that booking wrestling is like putting a puzzle together, except you don't have the corner pieces to start with, and you don't have the picture on the top of the box of what the puzzle is supposed to look like. But you still have to put the puzzle together. Mm-hmm. And that's a great analogy, because there's so many moving parts and so many personalities that you have to kind of deal with. And I think a lot of times that makes me a little bit more soft, a little easier on some of these kind of bullshit finishes, because I can empathize with the struggles that the people having to put this finish together probably went through. But what about you guys? Give me a little bit more of kind of the fans' perspective of what makes a bad finish. What finish makes you feel like you've wasted my time?
Trying to think. I think a finish that you can see a mile coming and you don't like. So, for instance, some of the stuff that we had in the fall of 2013 with Brian.
Yeah.
I think there was a Hell in a Cell match that I think most people could have seen the finish to. There was the what else was going on?
Some Night of Champions match. I think that might be the last Dusty finish they've done before Sunday.
Yeah,
best count. Yeah, with the fast
they took
count.
They took it back the next night. The pay-per-view went off the air with Brian with the belt, I think. And they took it back the next night.
Yes.
Right. Just a show that a main event finish that you feel deflated from. You feel like there's been no progression. You feel like it almost kind of took a step backwards.
Yeah, you said main event, and I want to get Dan's thoughts in just a second, but you said main event. Is it significantly more egregious in the main event than in, you know, the tag title match or the third match on the show? Obviously, you know, that's the last thing, that's the last taste it leaves in your mouth, but is it significantly more egregious in your opinion?
Well, yeah, because that's the focal point. That's the lasting memory. That's what the show leaves with.
Yeah, I think
so. Whether it's good or bad, that's what we're supposed to remember.
Yeah, I think that's an opinion that a lot of people share. Dan, what about you? What as a fan, as a viewer, as a consumer of content, what type of finish infuriates you?
I think the worst finish is a no finish. It's basically, you know, basically an instance where something that's just unimaginative comes out of the blue. You know, the old adage of like the double DQ or the double countout, or the guy who, you know, I think we recently had a match on pay-per-view in which King Barrett just, you know, gets knocked out of the ring, and then he just decides, I'm not going to get back into the ring. I'm just going to stand right here on the apron, and then gets counted out. Like, it's just like, okay, thanks for nothing. That it's kind of, you
know, I don't want to that's a good opinion. I mean, that's it's a valid argument, but I think so rarely do we see those kind of finishes now that I think they almost carry more weight. So it's not like this is 1990 and Earthquake doesn't want to get back in the ring with, you know, Ultimate Warrior, and that's been a finish that has happened a dozen times or more. This is Barrett. I mean, it just seems like it's more strategic now.
Yeah, it what it screams to me is I could have easily have seen that on SmackDown. Like, a guy just gets knocked out of the ring. Ah, screw it. I'm just going to throw my hands in the air, and that's the end of the match. It's just, you want to talk about deflating. That's how I kind of feel. Now, granted, that's a mid-card match. You're not going to go home and, again, get all upset because a mid-card match ended with kind of a fart. But at the same time, it's one of those type of finishes that just kind of gnaws at me a little bit. The other is one that we did see a lot during, like, the early 90s was, you know, and we saw it on, like, WrestleManias and free shows alike, basically, is the guys tumble over the top rope, just continue to beat on each other on the outside, start beating up each other up the rampway, and then the bell gets called for because, well, it's either going to be a double DQ or both guys get disqualified for not following instruction. It's just, ugh, gross. I'm not a fan of those either.
I want to touch on something you said there. It's a finish that you could have just as easily gotten on SmackDown. Mm-hmm. So with the concept of true pay-per-view wrestling pretty much being a bygone thing, and now everyone watches via the network, most everyone watches via the network, your expectation remains the same as if you were paying a premium price for the show. Is that correct? I that's what I gather by you saying that's a finish I could have just as easily seen on SmackDown.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's one thing if it's, you know, a crutch to kind of, or basically it's a bridge to get you to the next big show. It's like, okay, well, he doesn't want to fight because he wants to live to see another day, and there's not a lot of high stakes here on Friday night or Thursday night, but when they really get together on the big show on Sunday, man, it's going to be something, and there's going to be some closure, and there's going to be a definitive winner, and then you just see it again on the pay-per-view.
So the expectation for you does not change, even though the show now has a far reduced price point than it did years ago. The expectation is still there because it is presented as a special event.
Right.
What say you to that, Graham?
I think of what we're seeing now is essentially, and I've said this before, the monthly MSG show.
I agree 100%.
So you you can't finish every story on every show. You can't start every story on every show. You kind of have to have those continuation pieces. You kind of have to have the part one of the five-part series and be aware that it's going to happen at some point. Because if everyone got a clean clean finish on every match, well, where do we go from here?
Yeah, there's something – I think you're right about that. I think for a lot of people, the expectation has changed somewhat because it's not like we're paying $50 for these shows anymore. You know, most of us would subscribe to the network anyway for NXT or for whatever. So the pay-per-view has become kind of like a bonus. It has become, I think, in a lot of instances, even for people who look forward to it every month, it has become kind of like the monthly MSG show. I don't know what exactly to attribute this to, but there is a different philosophy in general. Maybe not even philosophy. Circumstances just feel different. And what I mean by that is back in that era, and anybody that's watched a lot of shoot interviews with older guys has maybe heard this before. Back in that era, Vince Sr. would give you your start date, your finish date, and who you were going to work with. You're going to come in for 4 months. You're going to work with Backlund and then Pedro, and then you're going to put over Strongbow on the way out or whatever. And for or even in the South, it was more geared toward, okay, we're 16 weeks away from the cage match. Okay, now we're 12 weeks away from the cage match. Now we're 8 weeks away from the cage match. It was more Southern booking a lot of times was more kind of towards that, whether it was the Big Show or the cage match or the loser wears a chicken suit or whatever it was. For whatever reason, be it the corporate infrastructure, be it guys getting hurt too much or people's contracts coming up due at different times, it seems like wrestling can't successfully do that anymore. It seems like you can't say, okay, Dolph, you are going to work with Barrett. We are 16 weeks away from SummerSlam, where you guys are going to have a cage match for the Intercontinental title. This is where we want to be in 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. For whatever reason, and I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's the corporate infrastructure. I don't know if that's attention span of the audience. I don't know if it's wrestlers breaking their bodies down at a more rapid pace. But for whatever reason, it has become – wrestling has become something that does get booked week to week and almost on the fly, whereas it was never like that before. And I think that makes it a lot harder to set out to tell even like a five-show story or a five-month story. And that's kind of what gets me back to the thinking that 26 major shows a year, it might make it a little easy. Yeah, you'll burn through a lot of matches and a lot of rivalries and a lot of finishes. But it might make it easier to keep the shows more focused. Graham, as somebody who has gone back and watched a ton of television from the 80s and 90s and beyond, do you notice that trend too? That it seems much, much harder to tell an episodic story in modern wrestling.
It is. And that's why when I see things like a count out, I think DQs are done way too often. That doesn't really mean anything right now. But a count out or a double count out or, you know, something that necessitates a return match, that's good. I think back to what would be a good example? The Bruno era, the San Martino, Morales, Backlund. What you would see a lot, especially when it came to MSG, is their challengers would typically get 3 or 4 months against the champion at the Garden. And the first match would be a win by count out or win by DQ. And then they would have the return match where, you know, the DQ was waived or the count out was waived and you couldn't end the match that way. And then they would have the, you know, if the champion was counted out or was disqualified, he would lose the title. And they would have all these different stipulations that they could work with that would build on each other. And then the end result was the cage or the loser leaves town. And it over the span of 3 or 4 months, all that booking made sense. Now what we're living with is a society and a fan base that wants every match to be the end result. They want that fulfillment. They want that conclusion. And you can't tell these year-long stories or six-month stories with that. I remember a good example of that would be the Raw after WrestleMania in Atlanta a few years ago. And I was at that Raw, and Cena and Rock come out, and they go, "I want a match with you at next year's WrestleMania." And I remember I was going, "Holy crap, that's awesome. They're giving this a year-long build." Meanwhile, the crowd was booing. They wanted that now. They wanted that there. And I was going, you know, in my head, they're giving this a year-long build. They're going to put time and effort into it. Next year's WrestleMania is going to be fantastic. And it was. But to that Raw crowd in Atlanta that wanted to see that match then and there, which, you know, had that happened, would it have meant anything 6 weeks later or, you know, 6 months later? Probably not. They give it a year-long build, which another good example of that, and it was completely by accident, is you look at WrestleMania 5. Ted DiBiase jumps Jake Roberts at ringside, or, you know, they have their altercation, and then at WrestleMania 6, that's the match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you forget about that. And DiBiase and Roberts interacted throughout that entire year. They were on opposing Survivor Series teams. You know, there was always, like, you know, chicanery where, like, you know, Virgil, I was going to say Vincent there, man. I've been watching too much WCW lately. But you'd have Virgil kind of interfere in Jake matches. You'd have, like, Jake putting the snake on Virgil. And then and you'd have all kinds of different things. You know, Jake steals the million-dollar belt. There was week after week after week, you're like, man, when are these guys finally going to get their hands on one another? Because even when they teased it, I remember Survivor Series 89 as being a time like, this is it, this, he's finally going to get him. And of course, DiBiase gets a cheap pin, doing some underhanded tactics, feet on the ropes, but Jake still gets the DDT on Virgil, and it's like, man, I swear this is when he was going to get him. And then the Royal Rumble, like, same thing, and then finally you get to that WrestleMania match, and some critics have said that, well, you know, DiBiase didn't bring it in WrestleManias and that sort of thing. Be that as it may, it did take, you kind of forget now, but it did take a long time before they finally got that big match, that big, you know, payoff, and you just, it's impossible to think about that nowadays, because you're right. I mean, some people, I think, were even complaining that we got in 2012, when the following year, when Cena and Rock, you know, they shake hands, let bygones be bygones, then all of a sudden Brock Lesnar comes out and he, you know, annihilates Cena, and then at the next pay-per-view, that's when you saw that big match between Cena and Lesnar for the first time in ages, and it turned out to be a really great match, but it didn't need that huge, long build. But you still have critics on that side too, saying, "Man, they should have maybe stretched this out a little bit."
That DiBiase Roberts match is an interesting one to cite, because Graham, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't DiBiase win essentially the blow off match in that year long feud on a count out?
Yes. But there are many stories told there.
Sure. That's what I'm saying. It's not necessarily an example of a bad finish just because of that.
Right. And, okay, so in actuality, Roberts had some legal troubles. So he was off for several months, which is another reason why it took a year to wrap that up. When he comes back, and you can look at the MSG shows from that point, you know, they immediately do a house show run. And they do a house show run with Virgil interfering, leading to DQs. Then they do a house show return with, I think it's like Virgil banned from ringside or no DQ, so that kind of stuff. And then they go into the bit where Jake steals the belt, the million-dollar title, and that's like in January. And then DiBiase starts having issues with Boss Man. And then they go to WrestleMania, and DiBiase gets his count out, but he gets DiBiase's money in the end, and gives around to the fans at ringside.
Right, yeah. What do you – you don't even – sometimes I think there are people maybe listening right now that don't even remember that that's what the end result of the match was, you know, DiBiase via countout. They might have also forgotten that DiBiase hit under the ring and then attacked Boss Man right before his match. But what you do remember from that match is he gets the DDT, knocks – DiBiase out. He does the bit with the money, you know, basically giving Ted DiBiase a taste of his own medicine. And then he hands out dollar bills to, you know, $100 bills to fans, including
Harry Tyler.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
She need it.
Yeah.
I think we've ventured into interesting territory here because, you know, it reads so much different if you just read Ted DiBiase defeated Jake Roberts by countout in, say, one of Graham Coffin's excellent books, then if you actually watch it and in context see everything that unfolded. And I think a lot of people kind of lose sight of that sometimes. There are some great DQ finishes that can further a story or get us to a return. And I think that style of booking is only going to become more and more prevalent by WWE as they try to get mileage out of everything and they try to get returns out of everything.
Yeah, I think my reaction to Ambrose Rollins was, holy crap, they're bringing back something that we have not seen in a long time.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in a way – see, the whole Dusty finish is – it became a cliche. But what it was at the core – was it's a hope spot for a babyface to win the title, have it be screwed from him, and then set up those return matches in which the fans go, I know he can do it because he already did it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait to see him do it again. So with specifically the Dusty finish, you can look at Starrcade 85. With Dusty and Flair. Dusty gets the pinfall, wins the title, but because Ole and Arn interfered, that title is, you could say, unfairly taken from Dusty, so he has to chase it again. But the fans, oh, he already had a big payoff moment on the biggest show of the year, so we know he can do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Bash 88 with Flair and Luger, they're establishing Luger as the next guy, and they do it in a way that he came this close.
Yeah.
He had Flair. He had Flair. But because of the stupid athletic commission, and believe me, in the Baltimore book that's coming out, a lot of people talk about the athletic commission in Maryland. But the stupid athletic commission screwed him out of title. Flair has the belt, but he is not the champion. And I think you see that same – it works for Ambrose because going into Sunday, and I made this comparison on Twitter – you know, it's a lopsided feud. We know that the champion's not going to lose the title, but you could say the same about. And I was specifically talking about something like Flair and Juan Garvin, but it equated to Rollins and Ambrose because at this point, we've never seen Ambrose pin Rollins on television.
Yeah, I think that there's something to be said for that too. There's something to be said for. Particularly a babyface, but sometimes a heel, depending on the circumstances. But there's something to be said for particularly a babyface that may need the support of a finish like that, as opposed to, let's just say, Cena, and I'm not a Cena detractor whatsoever. Frequent listeners
of
the show will know
this.
Exactly. Cena doesn't need that support. Cena doesn't need that. It almost... If that exact same finish were to happen with Cena against Rollins, it almost hurts Rollins. Actually, I think it does hurt Rollins more than it helps Cena. But when, you know, it's all circumstantial. And I think another thing is what kind of return are we looking at? One of my favorite pieces of advice I ever saw, it was on an interview with Terry Taylor. Terry Taylor said he got it from Kevin Sullivan. And I have literally taken this with me in all my travels from the moment that I heard it. Kevin Sullivan's philosophy, who booked in Florida and some in the Carolinas and all over, Kevin Sullivan's philosophy was, if you can't book the match, the finish, and The Return don't book the match. Those are the three things that you need. The three things that you have to have are the match, how's the match going to go, the finish, how's the finish going to go, and what's the return? What are we coming back with whenever it is that we come back? And those are the three things that I always ask myself at CWF with, you know, everything of substance that I do is what's the business of the match, what's the finish, and what's the return? And so in my opinion, Ambrose and Rollins checks all three of those. They had a great match. They did a finish that elevated the babyface, and it's very traditional finish for the heel champion. And we're going to get a great return at the Money in the Bank show off of it.
Now, here's a question for you. We know the match for Money in the Bank. What is the finish? And if there is no return, and I think in this setup there is no return, what is the direction from what is in my mind a Rollins retaining the title?
If I'm in charge of things, and this is, again, this is very traditional, but if the participants are key, if the key participants are big enough and strong enough, then it'll get over big. I think, you know, Rollins, theoretically, because we're, what, 5 weeks from SummerSlam at that point, at the point of Money in the Bank, give or take, maybe 6 weeks, but give or take. Money in the Bank is earlier now. It's in June, so we're closer to 2 months from SummerSlam. Regardless, I think it is, you know, Rollins retaining with chicanery. Theoretically, assuming that the issue is over, which I'm not privy to that knowledge, but I'm going to assume for the sake of argument that the issue is over. It's Rollins retaining with chicanery and, you know, clasping the belt in his hands. The chicanery should lead Ambrose in another direction, very much like how they did the Hell in the Cell finish last year. And I think the return in this case is Rollins is clasping the belt like it's his child, and whatever is going to be his SummerSlam issue, you get the first tease of it in that moment. That's how I would do it.
I've got
Rock's music or whatever that I think that. But now I'm not privy to the inner workings. You know, is there one pay-per-view in July or two, or, you know, they may try to get another return out of it. This July pay-per-view, you might get the Shield three-way that people have been clamoring for, in which case the return is different. But based on the knowledge that I have, and of the schedule and everything, that's how I would see it, is the start of Rollins' SummerSlam program. And hopefully there's some type of chicanery in the finish that leads Ambrose in another direction.
Yeah, my thought right now is they go one of two ways. If Rollins is left alone in the ring, then we get a Lesnar return setting up SummerSlam. If it's a different situation in which there's a giant brawl at ringside, Reigns comes out. I see Reigns as kind of, you know, okay, you got by Ambrose, but I think Reigns, it becomes Money in the Bank at the pay-per-view, and he's kind of like, all right, you got by Ambrose, now I got my eyes on you.
See, I agree, and I think that's a great story. I think that's so cool. If Reigns wins the Money in the Bank match, and Reigns has possession of the briefcase, and Reigns can fuck with Rollins this whole time and say, I am going to do to you exactly what you did to me, except for I am going to make you crazy waiting on when that moment is going to come. It becomes like the slap bet from How I Met Your Mother.
Yes.
He is going to, I think that's a great story. Mm-hmm. And I think that does a lot for Reigns as a character. And, you know, even when it's a heel, the Money in the Bank cash-in is one of the most exciting moments of the year, every year. So it guarantees that Reigns' coronation as champion is an incredibly exciting, fulfilling moment, no matter, you know, assuming that he cashes in successfully, which I would assume, you know, I think him walking around with that briefcase and basically tormenting Rollins is great television and gives a great payoff that sets up for success the guy they've been trying to set up for success this whole time.
Yeah, I feel like, right. I feel like they haven't had the opportunity to be creative with a face winning the briefcase in quite a while. I mean, in recent memory, Cena won it and then told everybody when he was going to do his challenge. But it seems like it's always kind of been now recently, it's like the popular heel in the mid-card wins the Money in the Bank briefcase, and then he kind of carries it around. It's almost like a de facto title in a way, because they're almost treated like they're the main event at this point, because at any given moment they could be in the main event and be champion. And, you know, we started with Dolph Ziggler years ago where he wins and he becomes – he's more popular than anybody, and he basically turns face in the process. You see guys like Sandow win and then challenge what looks like a defeated man only to lose, but you really haven't seen a situation, and it makes perfect sense in this regard to have Reigns do that sort of thing, because again, he has a history with Rollins. He wants that title more than anything in the world, based on what we have seen on his documentary, based on what we saw at WrestleMania, the beating that he took to try and win that belt, and you know, just the past history and being betrayed by his brother in the past. So it is, I mean, it almost kind of telegraphs it, you know, we come up with these predictions and watch Money in the Bank will be won by somebody like Kofi Kingston or something like that, because everybody's pointing in the direction of Roman Reigns. But be that as it may, I think it does tell the best story. The other rumor that I've heard about is this could be an opportunity for Reigns to turn heel, and maybe I'm just saying, I'm throwing it out there.
That's that just goofy.
If Ambrose were to win at Money in the Bank, only to get screwed by his, you know, his brother, his best friend, because that's been telegraphed over the last few weeks, is how close friends these two guys are, and they would take a bullet for one another, only to turn around and have Reigns do to Ambrose what Rollins did to the Shield. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but it's out there, and again, who knows what direction they'll go.
That devalues everyone, especially Rollins. Because where does Rollins go from there?
Right.
Yeah. And I think of the three, he's the guy that is not going to be devalued. The way that they, you know, like we were talking about WrestleMania, and Graham, at the end of the night, you said, you know, that's the guy that they've protected more than anybody this whole time. We should have, you know, seen it coming, whatever. And I think he still is the guy that I think is going to be taken care of at the end of the day. So anything that puts him out in the cold, I think, is probably not going to happen.
That's why I think whatever talk about him losing to whoever at SummerSlam, I think this may have come up when I was there for WrestleMania, is you do SummerSlam with Lesnar and Rollins, and you have Rollins win. Like, he brings out a bazooka, he brings out a tank, whatever. You have Rollins win. And then fast forward a few months, Lesnar wins the Rumble, because we all know that no one can beat him fairly. And then the next night, you have Reigns come out and say, all right, Rollins, you got your WrestleMania match. Well, guess what? I'm in it too. So you essentially, and this is my fandom of long-term booking, but you get Rollins, Reigns, Lesnar 2 at WrestleMania.
I think that certainly could happen. I think you also could very easily get that at SummerSlam with not nearly as exciting a build, but a potential nonetheless. And this is something, this gets us a little bit away from finishes, but it gets us back to current events. I'm ready for Lesnar and Austin. Like, if anyone that saw the Austin podcast, I'm ready for Lesnar and Austin. Like, where do I punch my ticket for that? Because I thought that was some captivating television with Austin and Heyman selling the prospect of that dream match in the last 5 minutes of the Austin podcast. And I feel like even if even if Heyman and Austin kind of went into business for themselves there, which I don't necessarily know if they did or not, but even if they did, they don't go into business for themselves unless they want that match to happen. So there are forces that want that match to happen, in my opinion, and it would not be at all.
I'm just reminded of, what was it, Hogan and Austin that was really teased on Raw years ago.
Yeah, maybe.
And that just, it, like, I'll believe it when I see it. I just don't know if I can see Austin, who hasn't done anything really that physical and since 2003, going against that monster.
Yeah, but he's got that credibility, man. That was, you know, I remember hearing Cornette talk that Austin was the one guy the fans believed in. And when Austin shook McMahon's hand at WrestleMania 17, it killed the territory because that wasn't what the fans wanted to see. He had that Von Erich-like appeal that he – not only did people love him, but people believed in him. And I feel like he still has that aura about him wherein you discount that he's however old he is and however many years out of the ring and whatever, just because he just has that – star presence. And I think Hogan has it too, to the extent of, you know, people will still want to see Hogan doing things, you know, far beyond his physical prime because he just has that aura and that presence. And I feel like Austin has it too. I don't know, Dan, what do you think? Have you seen the Heyman podcast? Or did you feel the same sense of energy and excitement for the tease of that match? Or are you more with Graham that you'll believe it if you see it?
I think just because, I mean, it's the huge venue. It's in Texas. He's, you know, the Texas guy. It's basically everybody's, you know, labeling this as if this WrestleMania is in his backyard. He hasn't wrestled in a while, but if you kind of read between the lines when you listen to his weekly podcast, he's keeping in shape, he's watching his diet. Obviously, he's on TV a lot with his shows, so he doesn't want to look like a fat ass. But at the same time, he doesn't have to do anything anymore. Like, he probably has more. He's very he always talks about how savvy he is with money and how he's not a big spender, although he probably has more cars and all that jazz. But he doesn't let on that he's basically just making it rain. But I think that he's been savvy. He's been keeping in shape. And if there was an opportunity for him to go and perform again, because he always kind of, you know, has those things in the back of his head that, you know, that WrestleMania 19 was his last match. He never returned, never fought, never took another bump. If there was an opportunity, it would have to be the right opportunity. And I think in the house that Jerry Jones built in front of a record-setting crowd and against a guy that he respects and a guy that was one of those missed opportunities, one of those wrestling what ifs. What if Austin versus Brock? I think that would be.
It was supposed to happen, and it never happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it was supposed to be King of the Ring.
Exactly. If that would probably be one of the only ways you would see Austin in a ring again, you know, taking bumps and actually working a match would be in that situation, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's the dream scenario that a lot of people have talked about. And hopefully it will be a gratifying experience for everyone. Hopefully they will deliver. And I think that's the real meat of what we're talking about is does that deliver? Does what we're watching, you know, make us feel cheated or gypped, or does it make us feel like, you know, this was a worthwhile investment of our time?
One of my favorite, because I think it's got layers to it. One of my favorite finishes is Flair and Steamboat at Chi-Town Rumble. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. The tease of a dusty finish.
They did well. Okay, so this is February '89. A few months later, they had this. This is the Crockett buyout. So Turner's in control now. Mass exodus of all these guys that had been in the company for years, but they kind of just aged out. And so now they're pushing the young guys, the Stings and all these kind of guys. And you bring back Steamboat, who had not been there since 85, since Dusty kind of made himself the top guy in the promotion. And Steamboat saw that that was never going to happen for him. So they bring back Steamboat to work with Flair. And they set everyone up for something that they had just become so accustomed to at that point. They do the Steamboat coming off the top referee bump. Then a few moments later, as the referee's down, Steamboat gets the roll up or the cover. Another referee comes out. 1, 2, 3, new champion. But the whole crowd is like, okay, we know this is going to get overturned. Because that's just what you guys do. That's what you did 6 months ago with Luger, and that's what we've become accustomed to. It's what you did with Dusty. It's what you do. And then the original referee, I think it was Tommy Young, allows it. And that's when you really, I think, hear the pop. That's when you're like, it's legit. Steamboat just beat him. But that throwback, it almost tells the fans, this is what you're used to. We're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think it's always good when you can play with people's expectations like that. Boys, before we wrap things up here, anybody have off the top of their head, you know, we don't do a lot of prep for these, anybody have a favorite finish? Anybody have a historical finish that they absolutely love, whether it's something that they saw once or, you know, a tried and true finish that gets them every time? Anybody have finishes that they really love, that they get excited about, or that they, you know, it's like revisiting an old friend when you see that one?
It's kind of a random one. I just remember when I saw it, I was like, wow, that is just perfect. And I don't know if it's been duplicated at all, but because of the era that it was in and the people that were involved, I just was like, bravo for doing that. And again, you guys might laugh because, again, I'm not the big historian here, but it was SummerSlam 1997. You have Undertaker defending the title against Bret Hart. You have Shawn Michaels as your special referee. Obviously, everybody knows about the screw job and the history between Michaels and Bret and everything. And we don't have to go into that. Obviously, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. But the fact that you had the incident with the spit take, that was the greatest spit take ever, followed by the chair shot that rocks Undertaker's skull, and then the begrudging 1, 2, 3 that Michaels had to do because he had to, you know, there was stipulations involved, he had to make the 3 count, he had to award the title, the biggest crown that you can have in the profession, to his most hated, vile enemy. It was just, just thinking about it, I'm like, you know, I'm sure that you guys will have other things that you will throw out there. But it's one of those things where it's like, God, this, a home run knocked that sucker out of the park. It was just, it's just a fantastic, of course that's how it would end. Like, there's no other way you could have ended that particular feud. Thank God that didn't end in just some schmoz, let's go wrestle up the Iowa and have no finish. That's what I want for a big match feel, and we got it, and it just encapsulated the tension that was going on during that time period.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a good choice. Graham, you got any favorites?
You know, I was thinking about that. I think Flair Steamboat ranks very high for me as a one-time finish, but another one that came to mind is Bret Hart, Bam Bam Bigelow. Bam Bam runs in the corner, Bret kicks him in the face, victory roll, 1, 2, 3. If you've ever seen a Bret Bigelow match, that's the finish. It was King of the Ring. They had a match in Barcelona during the 93 tour. That was the finish. I think there was maybe another European tour or another, you know, like TV dark match bout that went the same way. That was a good finish for them. Fast forward to WrestleMania 10, Bret Owen, same thing, kicks in the face, goes for the victory roll. We know this works. We've seen it work before. Owen blocks it, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
So I like those subtle, you know, playing off of what we've already seen, but then taking a different direction.
Yeah, I always like that too. And I always like when it's something that a guy has used before and it, you know, it comes back to bite him or whatever. My favorite finish in recent memory, and some people liked this, some people didn't. It was somewhat of a polarizing finish. I thought it was a super creative, super fun finish. Was coincidentally the Extreme Rules 2012 that we talked about earlier with Cena against Lesnar, the Big Show Cody Rhodes table match finish. I fucking love.
Yes,
I thought that was brilliant, and it was neat, and it was different. We strive to do that. You know, people, you guys asked a little while ago about like CWF. We strive to do stuff like that finish at CWF. Like, how can we present something traditional in a new way or with a new twist or whatever? And man, I love that finish with Big Show stepping into ropes. Cody drop kicks the foot goes through the table, and Big Show has lost Intercontinental Championship. What a great way to beat Big Show. I thought that finish was great. My early favorite finish, my favorite finish for a long, long time. And yeah, like it's a little, the suspension of disbelief can be a little questionable, in times, but, there's so much no selling in wrestling now. I don't think people would even think twice about it. I love the superplex finish wherein the person who was in theory superplexed hooks
yes.
the feet of the suplexer for a small package and gets the three count. I love, and that's one you don't see a ton. I remember Dynamite did it a time or
Savage.
Two. Malenko did it once or twice, but it's one you don't see a lot. And I always thought that finish was neat. Back in the day, you were like, oh, well, the guy who got suplexed kind of no-sold the superplex. But now there's so much no-selling in wrestling, I don't think anybody would even notice. But I always love that finish. I think you're right about the victory roll finish, especially to beat a big guy. I think that's a good finish. And I love any time, like I said, anytime something that you know is in a guy's constant moveset gets countered. Like, I love whenever, you know, somebody knows that the Cena's, you know, comeback is coming and tries to slip out of it, or whenever they can play with expectations, I think that's
a great example of that is Hogan Warrior.
Yeah, absolutely.
No one rolled out of the way of the leg drop.
Yeah. For 5 years or 6 years or whatever it was, nobody did.
Oh, that was such a shocking moment. I was just like amazed, like, oh my gosh, what do you mean? Everybody's supposed to just take that leg drop.
Yeah.
The one more that I was thinking of, and I'd be remiss if we mentioned Bret Hart and didn't mention this particular finish. But I remember in WrestleMania 8 when he had Roddy Piper gets him in the sleeper, the move that he used against the Mountie in order to win the Intercontinental title. It was a big moment at the time. And then he gets Bret in the sleeper, and he kind of does that thing where he kicks himself off of the top turnbuckle. He kind of gets into the corner and then rolls up Piper for the win, wins the Intercontinental title. And then you fast forward years later, and it's Stone Cold Steve Austin in a desperate move to try it. He can't figure out how he can beat Bret Hart, so he goes back to an old use of the million-dollar dream that he learned from Ted DiBiase, and then Bret is able to do the same maneuver and win the match that way. Just kind of rolls him up. I always thought that was kind of a creative finish that, you know, only a mind like Bret Hart's would come up with. And
I think that's the only person who's done it.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
I don't recall that from anyone else.
Yeah, I agree. And I always love that finish as well. Boys, anything else we need to talk about? Anything we need to plug before we call it a day here?
No, I think we did all our plugs.
I think we did. Hope you've enjoyed hearing us. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, please check out all the other great shows on the Place to Be Nation. Please purchase History of Wrestling books. And please, if you get a chance, visit youtube.com/CWF Mid-Atlantic and give CWF Worldwide a try. Boys, this has been fun. And we will talk to you in the very near future as we continue to delve even more deeper and at greater depth to the history of wrestling.